Switching gears now to national security. A former CIA software engineer convicted in what the judge called, quote, one of the most brazen and damaging acts of espionage in American history. Joshua Schulte is facing up to 80 years in prison for leaking classified information to WikiLeaks back in 2017. The leak, called Vault 7, revealing how the CIA hacked Apple and Android smartphones in overseas spying operations and efforts to turn smart TVs into listening devices.
The following is an abridged version of a June 13th article published in The New Yorker about former CIA employee Joshua Schulte. The entire world, of course, knows about the CIA contractor Edward Snowden, but few have heard of Schulte, who has been behind bars and cycling through the legal system for exposing classified information since 2018. But before our story begins, there is one key distinction between these two men that I would like to point out. Edward Snowden was a contractor to the CIA, and therefore never an actual federal employee. So when you hear Snowden or the media referring to him as a spy, that's simply not the case. And the reason for this is that to be a federal employee with the CIA, one must have a college degree. While he was ostensibly good with computers, he is certainly not an engineer, as that would be an unaccredited title entirely undeserved. Edward Snowden had access to classified information, no doubt, but it was nowhere close to what Joshua Schulte could access. On March 7th, 2017, the website WikiLeaks launched a series of disclosures that were catastrophic for the CIA. As much as 34 terabytes of data, it's more than 2 billion pages worth, had been stolen from the agency. The trove, billed as Vault 7, represented the single largest leak of classified information in the agency's history. Along with a subsequent installment known as Vault 8, it exposed the CIA's hacking methods, including the tools that had been developed in secret by the OSB, the agency's operational support branch, complete with some of the source code. WikiLeaks stated, "This extraordinary collection gives its possessor the entire hacking capacity of the CIA." In the days after this colossal breach became public, the CIA declined to comment on the authenticity or content of purported intelligence documents. Internally, however, there was a grim realization that the agency's secrets had been laid bare. "I was sick to my stomach," Karen, the OSB supervisor, later recalled. "That information, getting out into a forum like that, can hurt people and impact our mission. It's a huge loss to the organization." Malicious code that originated at the CIA could now be attributed to the agency, and the potential fallout extended beyond the digital realm. A foreign target who had been hacked might now be able to identify the malware, determine when it had been placed on a device, and even deduce which trusted member of the inner circle had engaged in betrayal. In the estimation of another senior CIA official, Sean Roche, the leak amounted to a digital Pearl Harbor. But who could have stolen the data? In a statement, WikiLeaks suggested that the person who shared the intelligence wished to initiate a public debate about the use of cyber weapons. But WikiLeaks had also shown, quite recently, a willingness to be a mouthpiece for foreign intelligence services. In 2016, the site had released emails from the Democratic National Committee, which had been stolen by hackers working on behalf of the Kremlin. Vault 7, some observers speculated, might also be the work of a hostile government. James Lewis of the Center for Strategic and International Studies told The Times, "A foreign power is much more likely the source of these documents than a conscience stricken CIA whistleblower. Perhaps Russia was again the culprit, or might it be Iran? Given that the software exposed in Vault 7 had been maintained on a proprietary CIA computer network that was not connected to the internet, the specter of espionage raised another alarming possibility. Might a foreign adversary have obtained physical access, smuggling a tainted thumb drive into the CIA? Had the agency's own modus operandi been used against it? As the intelligence community mobilized to identify the source of the leak, the federal government found itself in an awkward position. Because Donald Trump, shortly before being elected president, had celebrated the hacking of Democratic officials, declaring, "I love WikiLeaks." Nevertheless, this new breach was perceived as such an egregious affront to U.S. national security that the administration was determined to get to the bottom of it. The FBI began an investigation, and agents worked around the clock. But an atmosphere of paranoia enshrouded the inquiry. One FBI agent described how a CIA officer who was approached for an interview reacted with reflexive suspicion, pointing out that anyone can say they're an FBI agent. The Bureau was pursuing what it calls an unsub, or unknown subject, investigation. A crime had been committed. We didn't yet know who had committed it, one of the lead investigators, Richard Ivancik, later testified. Fairly quickly, the agents ruled out a foreign power as the culprit, deciding that the unsub must be a CIA insider. They zeroed in on the classified computer network from which the data had been stolen and on the agency employees who had access to that network. Among those who did were the OSB hackers on the ninth floor of the agency's secret cyber installation in Virginia. This was a befuddling prospect. The OSB engineers devoted their professional lives to concocting clandestine digital weapons. Making public the source code would render their inventions useless. Why destroy your own work? As the FBI interviewed members of the team, a suspect came into focus. Joshua Schulte. Nestled west of Washington, D.C., amid the bland northern Virginia suburbs, are generic-looking office parks that hide secret government installations in plain sight. Employees in civilian dress get out of their cars, clutching their Starbucks, and disappear into the buildings. To the casual observer, they resemble anonymous corporate drones. In fact, they hold top-secret clearances and work in defense and intelligence. One of these buildings, at an address that is itself a secret, houses the Cyber Intelligence Division of the Central Intelligence Agency. The facility is surrounded by a high fence and monitored by guards armed with military-grade weapons. When employees enter the building, they must badge in and pass through a full-body turnstile. Inside, on the ninth floor, through another door that requires badge access, is a CIA office with an ostentatiously bland name, the Operations Support Branch. It is the agency's secret hacker unit, in which a cadre of elite engineers create cyber weapons. OSB was focused on what we referred to as physical access operations. A senior developer from the unit, Jeremy Weber, a pseudonym, explained, "This is not dragnet mass surveillance of the kind more often associated with the National Security Agency. These are hacks, or exploits, designed for individual targets. Sometimes a foreign terrorist or a finance minister is too sophisticated to be hacked remotely, and so the agency is obliged to seek physical access to that person's devices. Such operations are incredibly dangerous. A CIA officer or an asset recruited to work secretly for the agency, a courier for the terrorists, the finance minister's personal chef, must surreptitiously implant the malware by hand. It could be somebody who was willing to type on a keyboard for us, Weaver said. It often was somebody who was willing to plug a thumb drive into a machine. In this manner, human spies, armed with the secret digital payloads designed by the Operations Support Branch, have been able to compromise smartphones, laptops, tablets, and even TVs. When Samsung developed a set that responded to voice commands, the wizards at the OSB exploited a software vulnerability that turned it into a listening device. The members of the OSB built quick reaction tools. Anthony Leonis, the chief of another cyber intelligence unit of the CIA, said, "That branch was really good at taking ideas and prototypes and turning them into tools that could be used in the mission very quickly." According to the man who supervised the OSB, Sean, the unit could be, quote, a high-stress environment because it was supporting life-or-death operations. But while these jobs were cutting-edge and, at least vicariously, dangerous, the OSB was, in other respects, just like any office. A dozen or so people clocked in every day. "We were kind of known as the social branch," another OSB employee, Frank Stedman, recalled. The experience of OSB engineers bore some resemblance to the Apple TV drama Severance, in that each morning they entered a milieu with its own customs and camaraderie, one sealed off from the rest of their lives. Because of national security concerns, they couldn't take work home or talk with anyone on the outside about what they did all day. Their office was a classified sanctum, a locked vault. Like the crew of a submarine, they forged strong bonds and strong antagonisms. There was banter, plenty of it, much of it jocular, some of it juvenile. The coders were mostly young men, and they came up with nicknames for one another. One unit member, who got braces as an adult, became known as Train Tracks. When another brought food into the office one day, but didn't share it with some members of the team, his colleagues bestowed a new handle, Dick Move. The group's ultimate manager was a more senior CIA official named Karen, who acknowledged that the members could get boisterous, adding, "Folks could get a little loud, a little bit back and forth." Some OSB guys brought Nerf guns to work, not mere pistols, but big, colorful machine guns, and they would occasionally shoot darts at one another from their desk. Sometimes people got carried away, and work was paused for some sustained bombardment. But Silicon Valley was known for tricking out offices with foosball tables and climbing walls, and it's likely that the CIA wanted to foster a loose culture on the hacking team to help engineers remain innovative and, when necessary, blow off some steam. One of the Nerf gunfighters was Joshua Schulte, his real name. A skinny Texan in his 20s, he had a goatee and a shaved head. In what may have been a preemptive gambit, Schulte gave himself the nickname Badass, going so far as to make a fake nameplate and stick it on his cubicle. But others in the office called him Voldemort, a reference to the hairless villain in the Harry Potter books. Schulte and his colleagues worked on sophisticated malware with such code names as Angerquake and Brutal Kangaroo. The hackers christened their exploits with names that reflected personal enthusiasms. Several programs were named for brands of whiskey. There was Wild Turkey and Ardbeg and Lafroig. One was called McNugget. Though there was something dissonantly adolescent about naming highly classified digital hacking tools in such a fashion, it seemed harmless enough. If the tools worked as planned, none of the code would ever be detected. And if the target of an operation did discover that some nasty bit of malware had infiltrated their device, a silly name would offer no clue that it had been created by the United States government. Deniability was central to what the OSB did.
Pick up your wand, Potter! I said pick it up! Get up! Get up! You've been taught how to duel, I presume, yes? First, we bow to each other. Come on now, Harry, the niceties must be observed. Dumbledore wouldn't want you to forget your manners, would he? I said, bow! That's better. Now! Lucius! That a boy, Harry. Your parents would be proud.
Voldemort. He had left the agency in November 2016 and was said to have been disgruntled. He now lived in Manhattan, where he worked as a software engineer at Bloomberg. As Schulte was leaving the office one evening, a van check and another FBI agent intercepted him. When they explained that they were investigating the leak, he agreed to talk. They went to a nearby restaurant, Pershing Square, opposite Grand Central Terminal. Schulte may not have realized it, but the other patrons seated around them were actually plainclothes FBI agents who were there to monitor the situation and intervene if he made any sudden moves. Schulte was amiable and chatty, but when Ivanchek looked down, he noticed that Schulte's hands were shaking. Like drone pilots who destroy villages in Afghanistan from an air-conditioned trailer in Nevada, the engineers of the OSB experienced an uncanny incongruity between the safety of their surroundings and the knowledge that their work supported high-stakes covert operations abroad. "We were very mission-focused," Jeremy Weber recalled, "but you know, we had fun at work too." Schulte proved to be a capable programmer, and in 2015, he was granted a special distinction when he was made a system administrator for the CIA's developer network. Now, he could control which employees had access to the network that held the source code for the group's many projects. Being a system administrator was regarded, Weber said, as a privileged position. Schulte made good friends at work. He became particularly close with another member of the OSB team named Michael. They played video games together after hours or went to the gym. But Schulte could also be abrasive. "Josh was very opinionated on the way things should be done," Weber observed. "So he had some rough edges." In particular, if Schulte felt wronged in some way, he had a pronounced tendency to overreact. One day at work, he shot a rubber band at Michael, and Michael returned fire. "This went back and forth until late at night," Michael recalled. "He trashed my desk. I trashed his desk." The conflict escalated until both men were throwing punches. Schulte could get a little off the hinge, Sean remembered. At one point, agency officials decided to assign a contractor to a project named Almost Meat that was based in part on Schulte's code. "Josh was offended," Weber recalled. "He protested that his hard work would be handed to a third party, then sold back to the government at a markup. He threatened to file a complaint with the CIA's Inspector General, claiming fraud, waste, and abuse. Frank Stedman, who worked on Almost Meat, felt that the episode illustrated Schulte's tendency to react with a disproportionate response. The man, known as Badass and Voldemort, accrued another office nickname, the Nuclear Option. Schulte had been on the job for about 3 years when a new programmer named Amol joined the OSB. He sat near Schulte, and they were partnered on a project codenamed Drifting Deadline. According to Weber, Amol and Schulte didn't get along from the get-go. Initially, people ribbed Amol because he behaved in a professional manner that was at odds with the prevailing frat house vibe. Schulte liked to shoot Amol with his Nerf gun. As Amol grew more accustomed to the OSB's raucous culture, he started to fight back. He would collect Schulte's Nerf darts and stash them behind his desk. He began trolling others in the office, maligning their skills as coders, and devising his own cruel nicknames. He referred to Schulte as Bald Asshole. Amol was heavy, and Schulte reciprocated by making fun of his weight. Their bickering intensified. In October 2015, Amol complained to Sean, the hacking unit supervisor. "I have had enough of Schulte and his childish behavior," he wrote. "Last night, he shot me in the face with his Nerf gun, and it could have easily hit me in the eye." Schulte also wrote to Sean, saying that Amol was very derogatory and abusive to everyone. According to Schulte, Amol had told him, "I wish you were dead. I want to piss on your grave, and I wish you'd die in a fiery car crash." Such rhetoric, Schulte noted, does little to foster collaboration. Weber subsequently confirmed that Amol had indeed said some of these things, but he pointed out that Amol had done so only after protracted arguments with Schulte, and that the attritional verbal combat Schulte seemed to favor could exhaust a person. In March 2016, the discord between the two hackers reached a new level when Schulte lodged a formal complaint with security officials at the CIA, reporting that Amol had told him, "I wish you were dead, and that's not a threat, it's a fucking promise." Schulte characterized this as a credible death threat that had left him fearing for his life. He suggested that Amol was upset and unstable, and possibly bipolar. Schulte felt that his superiors weren't taking his accusations seriously. He neither liked nor respected Karen, his ultimate boss, referring to her as a dumb bitch. One CIA security official responded to the dispute by saying that he couldn't play high school counselor, which only exacerbated Schulte's anger. Schulte escalated the matter by complaining to the director of the Cyber Intelligence Division, Bonnie Stith, an agency veteran who oversaw several thousand employees. One might suppose that she had more pressing matters to contend with, but she offered to sit down with Schulte and Amol and try to broker peace. Initially, Schulte refused, saying that he was afraid to be in the same room with Amol, but she insisted. And at the meeting, she urged both men to consider the honor of being CIA employees and to remember their obligations to their country. Amol, she thought, seemed embarrassed to have been hauled before the school principal. Stith decided that the coders should be physically separated. "Our nation depended on us," she pointed out later. "I needed them to be focused." Schulte was furious to learn that he had to switch desks. He said that he would relocate only if his managers issued the directive in writing. So they did. Even then, he refused to fully move. He didn't like the new location. It had no window. "It was an intern desk," he scoffed. Amol, meanwhile, had been promoted to a better desk, leaving Schulte exposed to questions and ridicule about why he was demoted. Up to this point, though, Schulte could be vexing and obstreperous. He was working within the broad bureaucratic parameters of the agency. Others might have found his vendetta against Amol irrational, but he had confined it to traditional channels, pushing his appeal up the chain of command. Now he embarked on a more decisive escalation, concluding, as he later explained, that since the agency wouldn't help me, perhaps the state would. Citing fears for his safety, Schulte filed for a restraining order against Amol in Virginia State Court. This was a startling departure from normal conduct for the CIA. The agency has an estimated 20,000 employees, and because of the sensitivity of its work, it enjoys remarkable autonomy within the federal government, sometimes appearing to operate as a self-governing fiefdom. the notion of allowing an internal squabble to spill into the unclassified realm was anathema. It was so unusual to have agency employees in a local court, Stith later said. Amol was obliged to appear at an open hearing at a Loudoun County courthouse. Inside the agency, a security organ known as the Threat Management Unit was activated, and a decision was made to separate the warring OSB programmers even further, moving Schulte to a different branch altogether on the 8th floor. Schulte fired off an intemperate email. I just want to confirm, this punishment of removal from my current branch is for reporting to security an incident in which my life was threatened. Of course, it was also possible to read this relocation as a logical bureaucratic response to the restraining order that Schulte had obtained, which compelled Amol to avoid any contact with him, even crossing paths in the hallway. Leonard Small, an official from the agency's Office of Security, later said that Josh's escalating behavior kept going on and on. In an email to Small, Schulte threatened to go public, saying that a lawyer he had spoken to had suggested an article titled CIA Punishes Employee for Reporting Office Death Threats would be an article that the media would be very interested in. Schulte hadn't yet proceeded with this option, he said, because he was hoping there was an alternative. Others in the OSB expressed frustration with Schulte's refusal to drop the matter. At one point, Stedman observed, the boy needs to learn how to take his medicine. Nobody believed that Amol had posed a genuine threat to Schulte's life. Stedman later declared that the whole write-up is bullshit and exaggerated, and read like a fictional narrative. As an intelligence professional trained in the art of threat assessment, he considered it insulting that Schulte thought any of them might fall for such a ruse. Next, Schulte appealed to several of the most senior officials at the CIA, including Moreau Park, the executive director. I know you don't deal with personal issues and likely won't spend much time on this, but management's abuse of power and consistent retaliation against me has forced me to resign, he wrote on June 28, 2016. Schulte hung on a little longer, but by November he was gone. At Bloomberg, he would make more than $200,000 a year, a significant increase from his government salary. Though he was legally bound to protect the confidentiality of his CIA work, he could tell people he had been at the agency, and he discovered that in the private sector, this conferred a certain cachet. Reflecting on Schulte's good fortune, Stedman noted that sometimes good things happen to bad people. Before Schulte's departure, there had been one final fracas. Schulte was, in his own telling, trying to make the best of his situation and move forward. But after relocating to the 8th floor, he attempted to work on a program called Brutal Kangaroo, only to find that his access had been denied. Imagine my shock, he later recalled, noting that Brutal Kangaroo had been his project. He felt a huge proprietary investment in the program. Schulte consulted the audit logs on the system and determined that Weber had stripped him of his access. Weber later explained that his reasoning had been simple. In Schulte's new branch, he was going to be working on new projects, and therefore wouldn't need access to the old ones. But Schulte saw it as a retribution. He had developed a special resentment for Weber. At the Loudoun County court hearing on the restraining order, Weber had shown up as a show of solidarity with Amol. Schulte regarded Weber as a bureaucratic toady, Karen's loyal pawn. Weber, he felt, had played politics to overthrow me from my own project. And so, Schulte, without asking for authorization, reassigned himself access to his old project. When his managers learned of this, they were so alarmed that they stripped Schulte of his administrator privileges. Weber later said of Schulte's transgression, "The agency exists in a world of trust. We are granted access to classified information, and we are trusted to only use that information for the expressed reasons we're given access to it. If you can't trust the person that you're working with," he pointed out, "you're in trouble." Unlike other prominent digital leakers, Schulte did not seem like an ideological whistleblower. Ayn Rand fanboys are not exactly famous for their doctrinal consistency, and Schulte's concerns about Big Brother don't appear to have occasioned much soul-searching in the years he spent building surveillance weapons for a spy agency. On an anonymous Twitter account that Schulte maintained, he reportedly expressed the view, in a since-deleted tweet, that Chelsea Manning should be executed. Weber recalled Schulte saying that Snowden deserved the same. Could it be that Schulte had leaked the CIA's digital arsenal not because of any principled opposition to the policies of the U.S. government, but because he was pissed off at his colleagues? There are prior examples of CIA employees who have been driven to betray their country out of a sense of professional grievance. After an agency officer named Edward Lee Howard was fired in 1983 because he had lied about drug use and other minor transgressions during a polygraph exam, he began feeding the KGB sensitive intelligence. When the agency discovered the breach, Howard fled to Russia, where he lived until his death in 2002. After Ellsberg made the moral decision to leak the Pentagon Papers, it took him weeks of complicated work to make good on that objective. But with digital technology, the window between impulse and consummation shrinks considerably. And, as everyone who worked with Josh Schulte knew all too well, when he was mad, he had poor impulse control. Even as FBI investigators pinpointed Schulte as the prime suspect, their work was frustrated by the pageantry of overclassification. WikiLeaks had posted the Vault 7 tools on the web, where anyone could see them. But officially, the CIA and the FBI maintained that the documents remain classified. As a result, only investigators who held the necessary security clearances were permitted even to access WikiLeaks to see what had been stolen. FBI officials were so nervous about visiting the website using bureau computers or internet connections, thereby possibly exposing their own networks to a cyber intrusion, that they dispatched an agent to purchase a new laptop and visit the WikiLeaks website from the safety of a Starbucks. Once the Vault 7 materials had been downloaded from the internet, the laptop itself became officially classified and had to be stored in a secure location. But the evidence locker, normally used by agents, which held drugs and other seized evidence, just wouldn't do, because it was classified only up to the secret level. Instead, the investigators stored the laptop in a supervisor's office in a special safe that had been certified to hold top secret documents, even though anyone could go to the internet and see the materials that were on it. Soon after the FBI began its investigation, agents placed Schulte under surveillance, and they learned that he was about to leave for Mexico. Edward Snowden had fled to Hong Kong and then to Russia, where he remains, beyond the reach of U.S. authorities. Faced with the possibility that Schulte might abscond in a similar fashion, investigators made their move, with Agent Ivanchuk stopping him as he left work at Bloomberg and taking him to Pershing Square. It had emerged that when Schulte left the CIA, he had not returned his special black government passport, which assured the holder official status while traveling abroad. Schulte eventually acknowledged that he still had the passport, but maintained that the trip to Mexico was simply a spring break excursion with his brother. The investigators had a warrant to search Schulte's apartment, so they all went together to his building on 39th Street. It was full of computer equipment. When FBI agents obtained a warrant for Schulte's search history from Google, they discovered that starting in August 2016, when he was preparing to leave the CIA, he had conducted 39 searches related to WikiLeaks. In the hours after WikiLeaks posted Vault 7, he searched for FBI and read articles with such titles as FBI Join CIA and Hunt for Leaker. For a guy who was a supposed expert in information warfare, Schulte seemed shockingly sloppy when it came to his own operational security. Even so, the FBI hadn't found a smoking gun. It had amassed circumstantial evidence tying Schulte to the Vault 7 leak, but it hadn't found any record of him transmitting data to WikiLeaks, or indeed, any proof that the secret files had ever been in his possession. Schulte was not under arrest, so he got a room at a hotel while the search of his apartment continued. The FBI seized his computer hardware for forensic analysis. When computer scientists at the Bureau examined Schulte's desktop, they discovered a virtual machine, an entire operating system nested within the computer's standard operating system. The virtual machine was locked with strong encryption, meaning that unless they could break the code or get the key from Schulte, both of which seemed unlikely, they couldn't access it. But they also had Schulte's cell phone, and when they checked it, they discovered another startling lapse in operational security. He had stored a bunch of his passwords on his phone. One of the passwords let the investigators bypass the encryption on the virtual machine. Inside, they found a home directory, also encrypted. They consulted Schulte's phone again, and sure enough, another stored password unlocked the directory. Next, they found an encrypted digital lockbox, a third line of defense. But using encryption software and the same password that had unlocked the virtual machine, they managed to access the contents. Inside was a series of folders. When the investigators opened them, they found an enormous trove of child pornography. When Schulte was in college, he argued on his blog that pornography is a form of free expression which is not degrading to women and does not incite violence. He went on, "Porn stars obviously enjoy what they do, and they make quite a bit of money off of it. Of course, some women are coerced into pornography, and if you mistake the simulated enjoyment in a porn performance for the real thing, then you don't understand much about the industry. But more to the point, child pornography is not free expression. It's a crime." After Schulte realized that the illicit archive had been discovered, he claimed that the collection, more than 10,000 images and videos, didn't belong to him. In college, he had maintained a server on which friends and acquaintances could store whatever they wanted. Unbeknownst to him, he contended, people had used the server to hide contraband. He had so many people accessing it that he didn't care what people put on it. But according to the FBI, as agents gathered more evidence, they unearthed chat logs in which Schulte conversed about child pornography with fellow enthusiasts. "Where does one get kiddie porn anyways?" Schulte asked in a 2009 exchange. This was another instance in which Schulte seemed recklessly disinclined to cover his tracks. His Google search history revealed numerous queries about images of underage sex. In the chat logs, people seeking or discussing child pornography tended to use pseudonyms. One person Schulte interacted with went by HBP. Another went by Sturm. Josh's username was Josh. At one point, he volunteered to grant his new friends access to the child porn archive on his server. He had titled it home/josh/http/porn. Sturm, taken aback, warned Schulte to rename these things for God's sake. When FBI investigators searched Schulte's phone, they found something especially alarming. A photograph that looked as though it had been taken inside the house in Sterling, Virginia, where he had lived while working for the CIA. The photograph was of a woman who looked like she was passed out on the bathroom floor. Her underwear appeared to have been removed, and the hand of an unseen person was touching her genitals. State investigators in Loudoun County subsequently identified the woman and interviewed her. She has not been named publicly, but she told them that she had been Schulte's roommate and had passed out one night with no memory of what had happened. The encounter in the photograph was not consensual, she assured them. According to subsequent legal filings, the investigators concluded, after consulting the victim, that the hand in the photograph belonged to Schulte. On August 24, 2017, at 5:30 a.m., a dozen armed federal agents hammered on the door of Schulte's apartment in Manhattan, startling him awake. Once inside, they bellowed, "Turn around and put your hands behind your back." According to an account written by Schulte, he was led like a prized dog into the federal courthouse in Lower Manhattan, where he was cuffed and shackled, then turned over to the U.S. Marshals. At this point, the FBI and federal prosecutors had been investigating Schulte's possible role in the Vault 7 leak for 5 months, but they still hadn't indicted him. Instead, they now charged him with receipt, possession, and transportation of child pornography. Schulte pleaded not guilty. When he heard that the government was pushing to keep him detained pending trial, his stomach dropped. "The crime I am charged with is, in fact, a non-violent, victimless crime," he objected, displaying an obdurate heedlessness when it comes to how child pornography is made. A judge ultimately ruled that Schulte could be released on bail on the ground that he posed no immediate threat to society. But his release came with stringent conditions. He would be under house arrest, unable to leave his apartment except for court dates, and he could not access the internet. Schulte bridled at this, observing, "Today, everything is done online, so it's incredibly difficult." Never one to meekly adhere to a directive that he found objectionable, Schulte chose to ignore the condition. In December, the government presented evidence that he had defied court orders by going online and on several occasions had even logged on to the internet using Tor, a system that enables users to access websites anonymously. Meanwhile, authorities in Virginia charged him with sexual assault, citing as evidence the photograph discovered on his phone. Schulte was taken into custody once again and locked up at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Manhattan. He was still there in the summer of 2018 when the government filed a superseding indictment with 10 new counts and charged him with leaking Vault 7.